Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Ages Pros. Steve Greenfield and I are going to continue our conversation about Joe Biden. So over the past few days, a lot has happened. A couple more people dropped out. The endorsements for Biden are, like, unbelievable. So what's your take?
Well, there's, you know, just a couple of things to recognize in all this, which is that really all that's happened is that, you know, last week, the last 7 days, the last 10 days, the time between the South Carolina primary and today, whatever the exact number of days that has been, has really been the consolidation of the corporate wing's votes, you know, from the primaries and their voting pools into a single candidate, which is something that, you know, many people, not just me, you know, it's, you know, that we're observing from the onset of the primaries, of the Democratic entrance into their primaries, when it was clear that the overwhelming majority of the candidates were representing specifically the corporate wing of the party, and that they all carried various either biological identities or certain state affiliations in high vote states, that their purpose was to give people reason to vote without looking too hard at the platform they were voting for, and instead looking at identity issues and state location issues and things like that, where the intent was to create a brokered convention so that everyone would then grant their votes to whoever was in first place from the corporate wing of the party in order to make that person the nominee. And what happened, we were discussing this last week, all that happened that changed that that strategy slightly, it was just the backup plan to the same strategy, which is that, you know, Bernie Sanders jumped out to a significant lead in the early primaries and caucuses right away. Mm-hmm. And so rather than keeping everybody out there spending tons of money and continuing to divide up the vote that's coming to the corporate wing, because they could see that Sanders was getting so many votes that a brokered convention was going to become a very bad look, you know, that they were clearly going to be trying to sideline the plurality candidate, and that was going to be a terrible look at the convention. And so they realized that what they had to do is consolidate immediately and get all the other corporatists off the ballot and have all of them endorse Biden, so that Biden would at least be able to come in as the front runner. Even if he doesn't get a majority, then he would at least be the plurality leader ahead of Bernie when they come in, so that the brokered convention then going to him wouldn't look quite as terrible as if it was Bernie that was coming in with the plurality. So that's what they did, and that's what's happening. You know, I think the most horrifying example that we can look at right now for how this was intended to play out and how it's exactly playing out was the endorsement that Kamala Harris put out, the video of herself saying that she is, you know, enthusiastically supporting Joe Biden in this race, and that she has, you know, appeared in Michigan and other places to support his continued votes in the primary at this point, when she basically made her name and got herself as an early front runner in this campaign by attacking Joe Biden for his opposition to school desegregation and his close friendships and words of praise for people whose entire political careers were built on being active segregationists, and that, you know, she then sold T-shirts as a fundraiser immediately upon that. There's obviously a staged statement she had made, because the T-shirts were ready to go and raise money about how I was, that little girl was me, right? That the girl that was bused to integrate an all-white school and get a better education. And she jumped out to front runner status, you know, on the basis of that, and raised a ton of money. And now she's out there saying, I enthusiastically endorse Joe Biden for president. And so what's happening is that the electorate doesn't seem to care the degree of stagecraft and the degree of hypocrisy that went into setting up this primary, which was staged from the beginning to ensure they didn't know exactly what the outcome was going to be. That's why they brought in a whole bunch of corporatist candidates, because anything can happen during a primary, right? You can find, you know, find out somebody's involved in a crime, somebody did something, somebody cheated on their taxes, and that they're not going to be the surviving candidate. So I'm not saying that they absolutely fundamentally knew that Joe Biden was going to be the winner when they set this all up. But what they did was they flooded the zone with corporatists so that there would be no way for a progressive candidate to get enough of a plurality that they would be prevented from brokering the convention to at least one of the corporatists, right? And so that's what's playing out now. All those people that came in are doing what they planned to do from the very beginning, whether they were going to do it at the convention by awarding their delegates to a different candidate in a brokering process, or whether they were going to have to do what they're doing now, which is drop out of the race early and provide their endorsements to the person who appears to be the front runner so that he can come into the convention with the plurality and therefore make the brokering more palatable. So it's exactly happening the way everyone who was observing the onset of the process could see was going to be the outcome when it was all staged. And this ends up forcing us to confront the reality once again that the nominating process within the Democratic Party is staged, that it's not an honest democratic process where the members get to freely select the candidates of that they feel support, are aligned with their own policy beliefs, that it's a staged primary. Maybe that's a better way of expressing it than to say it was a rigged primary, because rigging sometimes sounds like, you were controlling the ballot booth, stuffing the ballot booth or whatever. So maybe staged primary is a better word, that it is a reality show that is staged and has a predictable outcome, travels along a predictable arc and has a predictable outcome, not because it's expressing the will of the voters, but because it's expressing the arc that it was staged to have. And so, there it is playing out in real time right now in front of us.
Okay, let me ask you this question. There was South Carolina, then there was Super Tuesday. And what they're saying on TV is large numbers of young people did not go out and vote for Sanders. Okay, we have a crisis with 46 million Americans to the tune of $1.5 trillion, where young people are burdened with debt. If you're burdened with something, wouldn't you go out to the polls and vote for somebody who says they're going to alleviate that problem for you? Why did not young people go out and vote and vote for Bernie Sanders?
I can't, as somebody who has been voting without interruption and has never missed an election since I turned 18 back in the fall of 1979, I can't really assess what the issue is with the younger voters. I'm old enough, as are you, to remember the days when the voting age was 21 and people were advocating for a change in a constitutional amendment to lower the age to 18. And the line that everybody was using back then was, because the Vietnam War was underway, and they were saying, if I'm old enough to be drafted and go die for my country, then I'm old enough to be allowed to vote, right? That was the message that was being used to change the voting age. And immediately upon that change being granted, there was no massive flood of people between the ages of 18 and 21 going out to vote. It simply did not materialize. I don't know why that is, right? The whole thought that everybody was having is that maybe we'd have less of an inclination to go to war if people who would actually have to do the going to the war were allowed to elect representatives, and that would somehow produce representatives that are less likely to go to war. That never materialized. The youth vote didn't exist, from the day that the constitutional amendment was made. It certainly existed. There was a little bubble of it in 2016 that did come out for Sanders. I honestly can't tell you. I don't know what happens in the mindset of people who are not voting when the candidates have clearly distinguished positions on matters that affect people's personal lives, not just the whole of society's lives. You will not find low voter turnout among evangelical Christians who want abortion stopped, right, or who want same-sex marriage stopped. They turn out in massively high proportions because this is personal to them, right? It's their religious identity and commitment. On the other hand, you look at people who are burdened by student debt, and they have two candidates from which to choose, one who wants to completely relieve student debt down to zero, and the other who actually went so far as to write and get adopted a law that prohibits you from being able to, have your student debt set aside, even if you have successfully filed for bankruptcy. So the distinction between the two candidates could not possibly be wider. You know,
right.
More an extreme and clearly identified distinction from your level of personal interest, where one is offering to completely unburden you from your problem, not even partially, but completely. And the other one is offering to completely burden you with the problem, even if you've already suffered the credit destruction of having successfully filed for bankruptcy and had all your other debts vacated as part of that process, right? So there couldn't be any wider of a gap and more obvious of a way to improve the quality of your own life than to make a choice between these two candidates. And people did not come out and do it. You know, I am not that clairvoyant to be able to comprehend why some groups that have a personal stake in issues that candidates have a range of opinions on and vote specifically, you know, if your issue is Israel, if your issue is guns, right, those people, they turn out. They turn out in you know, well above average percentages across the population on these things that are personal to them. These things that are personal to young people, will there be tuition-free public college? You know, apparently not. Apparently there won't be. Will there be student debt relief? Apparently there won't be, you know, because the people who will personally benefit from these things, and not just for the 4 years they're in college, but over the course of their entire lives, to not have to pay back, you know, $32,000 in loans so that they can't buy a house or rent an apartment or get married. Right? Like the ramifications of it, as we talk about all the time, the ramifications of it are wide. And over the course of their entire lives, you know, when my parents went to City College back in the 1950s, they were able to get married young. They didn't have to pay one penny of student debt back because they didn't pay one penny to go to college. They paid for their subway tokens. They paid for their subway tokens, which back then was a nickel. That's what they, you know, that's what they paid to go to college. They paid for their subway tokens, 5 cents a ride. So, you know, why didn't people turn out to improve their own lives by using democracy to influence political outcomes so that their own lives could be improved? I don't know. When those young people were demanding the right to vote because the Vietnam War was underway and they were literally potentially going to die because of war, or if they didn't want to go, either go into exile in a foreign country or go to jail was the, you know, the only alternatives they were facing. They pushed hard for the right to vote, and then they didn't come out and vote. And again, you know, not me, right? The reason I can't understand why they're not doing it is because I voted when I turned 18. I couldn't wait to turn 18. I was like, this is great. And even though it was an odd number of years. So in New York City, that was just local elections. You know, city council wasn't a presidential year. That was the following year. But, God, you know, damn it, I went out and registered to vote, like, on my birthday. And 2 months later, whatever, it was actually only a month and a half later. You know, my birthday's at the end of September. And so 5 weeks later, 6 weeks later, I was, you know, in my first voting booth casting a vote. So I don't know. And as much as I'm a person who believes, bringing this back to where we started the conversation about staged primaries, I have not, you know, I never voted for my local, you know, members of city council when I lived in Howard Beach, Queens. I always wrote people in. I voted third party. I mean, I know, but I voted, right? But I went out and voted, even though I knew that my vote, the fact that my vote would have no impact on the outcome, did not deter me from wanting to have that registered at the polling place, that that was my political preference and how I wanted to cast my vote. So I'm not the person to ask why other young people didn't feel similarly inclined, even though we all know, like I said, back to where we started this conversation with staged primaries, that we kind of know that we're in a trap here, and that our votes, that old line, like if voting could really change anything, it would be illegal. Well, you know, yes, even within that context, why do some young people view that and say, well, I don't even have to bother to go out and vote? And a very smaller number of young people, you know, who think more like I do or like you do, you know, go right out and vote. But I can't answer that question. I can't get inside the mass psychology of people who demand the right to vote and have massive personal stake in the outcome of the vote, and then they don't come out and vote.
Right.
I have no answer.
Okay, let me make this suggestion to everybody that's listening to this. If you could like All Exits Closed on Twitter, then I will like you. Follow me on All Exits Closed on Twitter. I'll follow you back. Send me a direct message if you were not inclined to vote to alleviate your student debt. I think that would be an interesting conversation. Now, let me take that one step further, Steve. You and I talked about sit-ins, demonstrations at the elected official at the Congress people in their district to stage something where it would get publicity. If people can't even go out and vote, I don't think they would be inclined to do a demonstration. What do you think?
I think you're right. You know, I think that that's actually true. I'm not going to pretend that I see much cause for optimism right now. In fact, quite the opposite. I see much cause for pessimism. I see the great majority of Democratic Party voters who are voting. You watch survey after survey, right? 85% of Democrats say that they support Medicare for all. Why aren't 85% of Democrats going out and voting for Medicare for all candidates if they actually believe that? I'm talking about the ones who do vote. And then what cause for optimism is there among the people who don't vote? If the people who do vote support various, if people who do vote support ending non-defensive wars and were against the invasion of Iraq, again, at 80, 85, 90% and higher levels, then why are they all gathering in polling places today to vote to nominate somebody who voted to invade Iraq? Why are they doing that? It doesn't make sense to me. And so if the people who actually claim to care about things who do vote go out and vote for candidates that are promising not to do the things that they want done, when there are other candidates on the ballot who are clearly viable, not a Dennis Kucinich or Mike Gravel getting, you know, 1% of the vote, but, you know, Bernie Sanders got 43% of the primary vote in 2016, right? So that's absolutely viable. That's close to half. You know, if 85% of you believe something, and there's a viable 40, then why is the candidate who supports all that only getting 43% of the vote instead of 85% of the vote? And bringing that up to 2020, why is that candidate only getting 23% of the vote? And somebody who actively supports, you know, all the things you oppose, like the crime bill, he's not going to legalize marijuana. He's going to keep jailing people over that, which is obviously a racist law, right? And he's not going to provide for affordable higher education, and he's not going to provide for debt relief for the unaffordable education that people have already received. Why is that candidate not getting 15% of the vote? How is it possible that candidate is getting? So if the people who vote are going in to vote against the things they believe in, and continue that as the policy of this country. And then, of course, there's the other people that aren't voting at all. Then what cause for optimism is there that significant numbers of people would be willing to take even more assertive action of the kind we've been talking about, civil resistance and nonviolent direct actions, in order to advance their own interests? What we're seeing right now is that people who are liberals and progressives and leftists, and even people with identity issues, like, right, why would a black person vote for Joe Biden? He's the author of the crime bill, and unlike certain things he's apologized for or changed his position on because he needs to get moderate voters and this is not one of them. He wants to make sure that we call the crime bill the Biden crime bill. He actually is branding himself according to that bill and promising this is a bill that has taken away the right to work and the right to vote. Even because when you have a felony, you lose your right to vote in most states. This is a person who overturned the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act and wants to be identified as that person in this campaign, and he's going to be continuing that if he becomes president. Why would a single black person, let alone the majority of black people voting, want that person to be president of the United States? You know, I admit I am now run completely out of even speculation, let alone answers about how something like that could be happening. I have no clue. I have no clue how someone with student debt would vote for someone to be president who identifies himself as the person who made student debt non-dischargeable at bankruptcy. Right? I don't know. I don't know how they could do that. But if they're not even willing to vote for it, then, you know, what stronger action will they take? I'll say, you know, I see no cause for optimism. You know, everyone believes in a Green New Deal. Everyone believes in stopping the combustion of fossil fuels. But they're all going out there and voting for people who want to expand fracking and want to continue expanding the use of fossil fuels. You know,
right.
We're seeing this right here in my own district. Right? I've already identified I'm now a candidate, right? And you're going to make sure that other candidates that may want to be on your show that your show is open to them because that is fair and reasonable. But right here in the 19th district, where everybody opposes fracking, everybody, every Democrat opposes fracking, you will find not a single pro-fracking Democrat anywhere in the 19th congressional district, and yet all of them are going to be voting for someone who is actively supporting the 3 fracked gas generating plants in or nearby our district, that they are out getting arrested for protesting against those plants opening. But they're all going to vote for someone who is fully supporting, through the power of his office, the opening of those plants. And his energy proposals include expanding fracking. And so
Which is your congressman, right?
What's that?
Which is your congressman?
Antonio Delgado.
Yes.
Okay. He came in here supporting fracking. He came in here supporting ICE and expanding ICE. He's doing all the things he came here saying he would do if he was elected, and he did not even draw a primary opponent. Okay, no Democrat is going to be running against him this year, even though Democrats are as close to 100% united against fracking as you could be, you know, and so I can't explain it. You know, I'm as much mystified as anyone who would be asking this question. How do you end up with, you know, the psychological burden of learned helplessness and obedience and Stockholm syndrome when it doesn't cost you a penny to vote? You know, it's not like anybody can force your vote in any particular way. There's no reason why people who feel very strongly about ending fossil fuel use should not have gotten together and brought forth even a token candidate just to make the statement in the primaries that we want peace, we want a Green New Deal, We want whatever it is that you want. We want debt relief. Whatever it is that they didn't even bother to bring forth. You know, last time around, there were 7 candidates that ran for this seat in a Democratic primary. Mm-hmm. And this year, we've got you've got the candidate. He's out there, and he is legislating completely opposite what everyone in the district says they want their legislator to be doing. And they couldn't even bring forth one candidate to come in. Like I said, not necessarily to have enough steam to win the primary, although you would certainly hope that it could work out that way, but to at least make the statement, this is what we want, and we're not getting it from you. But they didn't do that, right? Not even one sacrificial lamb would step forward and say, sure, I'll put my name on the ballot. And, you know, but that's what kind of brings it back to why I do what I do, right? I mean, I do civil disobedience. I do obstruction of actions that I find should be stopped, right? And the reason I'm in this campaign, the reason I'm running for this congressional seat again, is because that is another form of direct action. It is unacceptable that voters should have to choose between 2 pro-fracking candidates, a pro-fossil fuel Republican and a pro-fossil fuel Democrat, while the world is, you know, being destroyed by fires and floods and famines and crop failure, and that apparently, you know, doing something like that isn't one of the options that the two-party system is offering to voters. And so I'm out here, I'm getting in the way of that. Okay, that's just what I'm doing. I'm standing in the path of that. I'm saying wherever you may be going, one of you is probably going to become a member of Congress, but you're not going to do it without going around me. So I can't answer why other people don't do that, right? I'm not that person. My personal behaviors and thoughts are in the line of that these things are so terrible that they need to be obstructed. The idea that you would provide $2 billion of taxpayer funding to start developing a space force as if we are under a threat in this country of being invaded somehow from outer space, and that we need to be prepared for that when 30,000 Americans are dying every year from lack of health insurance, that's like a form of threat to our lives. 27 million people with no health insurance and 30,000 of them die every single year, 10 9/11s every single year, a grave threat that is predictable that another 30,000 are going to die next year and another 30,000 are going to die the year after that. But our member of Congress, our Democrat member of Congress, is insisting that we must not solve that problem, but we do have $2 billion to start developing a space force to protect us from some future invasion from outer space. And that sounds to me like insanity. I hear someone say that I don't have money to save 30,000 Americans that are dying every single year from illness and to save from bankruptcy another 250,000 per year that go into bankruptcy over medical bills. I don't have anything to give to them, but I've got $2 billion to give to Donald Trump to start developing a space force. This sounds to me like insanity. I don't see how any person could go out there and not stand with the full force of their person and whatever sacrifices they need to make with their personal lives to prevent that from winning an election. Because it's insanity. Cynthia, there's no kinder way to put it. That is insanity. You are willing to supply $2 billion to start building a defense shield against invasion from outer space, but you are not willing to provide that money towards building a shield against 30,000 Americans you know are definitely going to die next year and another 250,000 that are going to go bankrupt next year. Factually, you know that. And you're not putting your resources towards fixing that, but you are putting your resources towards, starting to research how to protect ourselves from an invasion from outer space. This is insane.
Our time is up, and I welcome Antonio Delgado to come on the show and explain his both on different aspects, student loan, the environment and stuff. And is there a Republican opponent yet?
No, they have three people. Their primary will be on June 23rd. You know, there's still no talk about even an emerging front runner in that race. So I have nothing. I have nothing on that.
Yeah. So, yeah, of course, this conversation will be continued. I've been talking to Steve Greenfield, and I'm sorry. If you like the show, follow on Twitter. All I can say, thank you, Steve. Have a great day, and thank you everybody for listening.
Thank you.
We'll talk later. Bye.